This is the RTE Rugby Podcast. We're available on iTunes, Spotify, RTE.ie, SoundCloud, or wherever it is you get yours from. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dara O'Brien, a rugby presenter here in RTE. Now, nearly all of us listening today are going to, I assume, have some relationship with rugby over the next while, whether you're a player, supporter, or just somebody who enjoys the pub atmosphere while the Six Nations are on. We hope we'll have something for you on the RTE Rugby Podcast. We'll try and engage with rugby at different levels at different times of the season. I suppose that's what happens in our lives too. And some of us have a very analytical side to our enjoyment of the sport. For others, it's mainly emotional. Hopefully, we'll bring you a good dollop of both. So let's step back now a moment and just let the good-natured side of our souls appreciate this. On Saturday, the guts of a million people will be watching the game. And as a pal of mine who's had a few health bangs recently said, it's the first bit of light of the year. An extreme way of putting it, maybe, but we're all optimistic and long may it last. Here we have a 32-county sport that is about to drag us on an adventure in 2019. A series of proper national sporting events anchoring a potentially nine-month-long white-knuckler of highs and lows and probably a good few bright-burning national shouting matches and scandals as well. So we're going to be trying to build a show around all that and who knows where it'll end up. And we're here in the 1970s glamour of the basement of Radio Centre in RTE, and we've shanghaied a number of colleagues who are lucky enough to earn a living by covering sport, some of them in telly, some online, some in radio. And I guess it's fair to say they live and breathe sports media and rugby. We'll get them along to tell us about what's caught their interest and imagination over the last few days. Later on, we'll have Alison Donnelly and Elaine Buckley on the women's campaign, which starts on RTE this Friday evening. Stephen Ferris drops in to tell us about the joys of climbing Kilimanjaro in wet tents and damp underwear, or maybe that's the other way around. And we'll have a nerdier look at how Eddie Jones will try to find rugby's current holy grail, the soft underbelly of the winning machine that is Ireland. But I'm joined by Wes and Michael. And I'll give you a quick intro. Wes Liddy is editor of Against the Head. I've known and worked with him for nearly 10 years. Initially, I didn't know what to make of the man, but I saw him mount a passionate and persuasive case for his buddy Alan Quinlan after he was banned from the Lions tour for alleged gouging. And Wes had broken down the incident frame by frame and opined that Quinny's digit dwelt on Leo Cullen's eyeball for such an atom-splittingly short time that the word contact could not be considered safely legal. I knew Wes was a man who knew his rugby. He likes to get detailed. Michael Glennon is also here. He's an RTE online journalist who I know from on many occasions just walking across the office floor with collegiate nuggets for us on Against the Head and other shows. He was also a stalwart of Eden Derry RFC for many years. He can tell you about that himself. And we're going to start with you, Michael, and what's been provoking reaction on the website.
I suppose most of it is in the build-up to Saturday's match and all the interest is around that from our point of view. Some comments that were addressed on Against the Head were John Mitchell's accusation that Ireland may win by boring point of shit out of everyone.
I think if you put the word shite in a corporate communication, it gets a kind of an out of proportion response though, doesn't it?
It possibly blows it up. I think maybe he knew that, or maybe he just was lobbing one of Eddie's famous grenades. That played out. I know Donal addressed it, and some the stats don't even back up the boring assertion. And the other thing is, if it's what you consider boring, but if somebody puts together 41 phases of play and they're perfect, and even if you know it's coming or it looks predictable, it's not boring if you execute something that looks so simple. If you execute that to perfection, that's actually not boring from my point of view.
You're a bit of a purist, so yeah.
Yeah, well, Johan Cruyff said playing simple football is the hardest thing to do. So it's not just because it looks like you know what's coming, and maybe Ireland can keep producing the phases and Leinster can do it, but it doesn't make it easy to do.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, I might be a cynical old goat, Wes, but it wasn't the substance of the point more than the reaction to it that kind of is funny.
Yeah, I don't even know how much reaction there was in terms of being...
A few people got annoyed.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose it's just sticking up for your team kind of stuff. I mean, to me, it means nothing really. I mean, do any of us care if they're boring us, if the victories keep coming? Probably not. I suppose there's always this kind of lofty pursuit of this balanced, holistic game, you know, with lots of wide attack to go with the box kicking and one-out runners. And to be fair to Ireland, I think it's been pretty widely acknowledged that in terms of throwing the ball around from deep, in terms of their shape and their counter-attack, and backed up by the stats, try score and bonus point stats from last year, from November, that it's John Mitchell who's talking a lot of shite, really.
Yeah, I think we'd leave it at that too. Yeah. What else is out there? I mean, what are the analytics? I mean, I don't genuinely understand. You work in online, so do you have this kind of stock ticker about what's provoking opinion and reaction on the site?
There is. That's in the background, and it's not that interesting for our listeners, but there is a most read section on the website where you can see what people are interested, what they're clicking into, what they're commenting on. There was one interesting one. Joey Carberry was up before the media. He was talking about his role since he moved to Munster and where he sees his place, because I guess when the new guys come along and they have their stalwarts like Sexton in place, maybe there's a bit of an understudy mentality. But he has come out now to say that that's not his idea. He wants to challenge the jersey, much like Sexton did for O'Gara and O'Gara did to Humphreys before. So he says he's not content to just stay there. And I presume that that's what Sexton and Smith want, that they don't accept lads coming in anymore who just want to be a squad member, that the mentality has to be that Carberry can take over from Sexton tomorrow, Larmer can take over from Kearney, and so on.
Yeah, the Larmer Kearney we'll come to later, because I mean the whole Robbie Henshaw thing is the kind of floater of the day. It seems to be getting traction that he's going to start at 15. We don't know until Thursday lunchtime. But yeah, I guess Joey Carberry, like out half's naturally confident anyway. I mean, the man is playing not just for the current 10 jersey, but he's playing for ownership of it for the next half dozen years.
Yeah, it's probably the most forthright I've heard him speak on anything. I suppose, funnily, for a guy that's been so heralded, we haven't actually heard from him that often. So I was kind of taken aback when I saw it, because I suppose Johnny's such an iconic player at this point. But yeah, I mean, of course he's gone in with that attitude. And there was obviously quite a bit of needle in the most recent derby over Christmas as well, but I could be completely wrong, but I mean, it seemed the hierarchy between the two was pretty clear for all to see in those interactions in that game. Johnny certainly wasn't standing on ceremony and letting him know who's in charge.
It's great chemistry, though. We go back to Johnny Sexton standing over O'Gara in Croke Park in 2009, and then they became buddies and colleagues in Paris. So, I mean, it is a genuine kind of mixture of respect and hatred.
Yeah, I think, I suppose with Rog and Johnny and what we know about him, you can probably see that those similarities in personality. Whereas, I don't know, is it just his style of play or what we've heard from him? But Joey seems a kind of breezier kind of guy. So I guess we'll get to know him over the next few years.
Yeah, that's a good point. Getting to know some of these players is difficult because they are very tightly managed and I guess they don't need the distractions. But, you know, the Shinsuke Lilla.
Well, the likes, some of the middle-ranking players now on the team, I mean, they're actually far more decorated than the legends of the noughties,
the golden generation,
O'Garas at this point, in terms of winning Six Nations, winning European Cups even, but we don't know them to the same degree. And maybe that's just our own imagination because they were kind of trailblazers in Irish rugby to some degree.
For sure, yeah. And it's an interesting discussion because if you look at the kind of character types that played in that era, you identified straight away, you knew, or you thought you knew, what type of man Paul O'Connell was, etc. These guys are more cookie cutter in their external communications, maybe. But look, go back to what you have on the website about Peter Stringer saying Owen Farrell, who's an ex-playing colleague of his, could be someone to get under, whose skin we could try and get under.
Yeah, because what Eddie Jones has been trying to do for the last, I don't know, 3 or 4 years is have a go at Sexton in advance, put him under pressure. But Peter Stringer was saying on the opposite side, if Owen Farrell lines up at 10, as expected, that he's a guy who can be got to as well. And he has discipline issues. Stringer said he's a guy who loses the rag completely, which you don't want from your captain. But so it works both ways. And we saw in the autumn internationals that Farrell got away with two no-arm tackles against South Africa and Australia. And if that's in his game, you know, it's something that you can take advantage of. And I don't think he'll get away with it. So if he tries it, he's not going to get away with it because it has been well flagged now. But so it's not just the Sexton angle. It works both ways.
Yeah, no, and it's a fair point because, I mean, obviously Dylan Hartley was a penalty machine, but he continued to be one despite having everybody pointing that out to him, and I presume his own coaching staff as well. Tell me a little bit your opinion about Farrell and his like, how is that a factor? Obviously, he's a factor in England's game. Is he a factor for us? Is there something specific to go after there?
Well, listen, if he has a suspect temperament, I think we've a pretty good source within the Irish camp that can maybe inform a bit of how they deal with him, yes. i.e. his father.
Daddy,
so
yeah.
We'll figure that out. The tackles against Australia in particular, I mean, they were almost ridiculous. They were so beyond the rules that you'd have to say, was it temperament or was it just terrible technique in that facet of his
exhaustion,
game?
Exhaustion, if you're being charitable.
Or both. But yeah. Yeah, I mean, he is a hothead, but I mean, much like Johnny, he's a competitor. And,
yeah.
You know, you can see it from his OCD approach to his goal-kicking stance, I think. You know, comes with the territory, but equally he's definitely a potential match winner from as well. It's only a year and a half since he was picked ahead of Johnny to start the first test of a Lions tour.
True. Just before we leave, what's trending or what's relevant or what's getting some traction, to use that terrible word, on the website? Well, anything, any new spy stories for us?
New spy stories? No, that's all quiet. I think that was at the launch last week. Smith was asked about it in the wake of the Leeds scandal. Or if it's a scandal, I don't even. It's not a scandal to me. But
yeah.
And Easterby was asked about it yesterday. And they're playing it down, maybe just to note it that you're being watched. But everyone knows for the last few years that the likelihood is that you can be watched. So what's the...
It's hardly Salisbury Cathedral.
They're well aware of it, exactly.
Tell me about Joe Schmidt's nickname, Cancel.
Cancelled, well, maybe
apocryphal, but go for it. It's
yeah,
a good yarn.
The story goes that years ago when he was playing for Mullingar, this would be in the mid-90s, a Midland League final against Eden Derry, and it was a dirty, dark day, and a lot of the moves were centering around Joe because he would have been a nimble back. And how do I put that? A lot of the Eden Derry players would have been not interested in what a rugby ball looked like, for want of a better phrase. And
they'd have enjoyed the physical combat.
Yeah, yeah. And there was a move called, and it involved Joe Smith coming in on an inside pass. And what happened was he saw the site in front of him, which was fairly agricultural. And what was heard on the sideline through the mist was, "Cancel, cancel." And then from there, the Eden Derry guys nicknamed him Cancel.
Which is good, because he's a man who accepts that if his plan isn't right, it can be
pleasant in front of him.
Yeah, and we know we never let the truth get in the way of a rugby anecdote anyway, so it's a perfect one for an after-dinner speech.
And good Kiwi inflection. Now, OK, if you're looking for a meaty read, you could do far worse than go to the RTE Sport website and read Declan Welly's feature on IRFU player management, how the IRFU micromanage Irish frontliners. Now, you did a fair bit of number crunching, Declan. Talk us through it for those who haven't read your piece.
Yeah, it's something we've heard a lot about in the last couple of years, about this player welfare management system that IRFU have in place. So I decided to look at probably where we've come from in a decade. So if you take the 2019, that won the Grand Slam, to Joe Schmidt's team, his first Six Nations team in 2014, to the current day, I've looked at how many minutes...
Three sets. So.
The three different teams, how many minutes these players are playing before the opening game of the Six Nations. And there's a clear trend. So in 2009, the year they won the Grand Slam, before that opening game, the average time was 902 minutes that each player had played for their province or club for 902 minutes. In 5 years, that had dropped significantly. And now we are today where if you take the Irish team that beat the All Blacks in November...
As our starting team,
yeah. And you put in Conor Murray, who's fit again, and Kieran Marmion, who's out, that average has dropped down to 686 minutes.
Okay.
So in effect, what that means is the players now are playing 2.5 games less on average than they were 10 years ago. So it's clear that the players are being managed, and this is a continual process. Now, the IRFU would claim that... they claim it's a fallacy that this is put in the national interest first, that it's to do with the provinces, academy players are looked after, the provincial players are looked after, and the national players. So they would say that when the frontliners go off to international duty, it gives opportunities to younger players. And you look at the likes of Fineen Richardy in Munster, Conor Brown in Leinster this year, they've come on a lot. They're getting much higher profiles, they're getting games. But it's clear that the focus in this programme, it would seem to be, is to make sure that the national team are competing at a higher level. And you look at the silverware and the amount of the games that they've won.
Yeah, nobody's arguing about that. It's working. And of course, the debate then about going to Interpros at Christmas or whatever and a lot of the frontliners being absent goes away when the Irish team can prove that the system is working. People are mostly reasonable about that. But why are the IRFU, you're just pointing out a fact that the average was 900 minutes, now it's 600 and whatever it is. But they reacted in some way that kind of, they were trying to tell you were wrong. I don't quite know how you were wrong.
I think it's more that the narrative around this that it's entirely Ireland focused, whereas they would claim that they're actually looking after the players right across the board, so that they're looking after, they're managing the amount of minutes that academy players are playing as well.
Yes.
They're not exactly front and centre in the national consciousness, but they're monitoring them in terms of, you know, injuries and everything that goes with it. So it's the welfare isn't just of the players we're seeing in Six Nations duty, is what they're saying.
Yeah, I mean, there's almost some implicit criticism that they expect in it. I can't see any criticism in the piece. It's kind of a fairly actuarial piece. But
And also the criticism also has come from supporters. And you look at even Matt O'Connor, the Leinster
coach. His parting
coach.
Shot was loud, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, at the time he claimed that the figure he threw it was that he only had his frontline players for 30% of the time when he was in charge. Now, there are a few, surprisingly, Schmidt and Nusafora came out straight away and emphatically shot that down, said that wasn't the case. Now, Matt O'Connor went a month after that statement. And, you know, you could argue that 30% may have just been plucked out of the air, but there's no doubt that he was more handicapped than he'd realised before he took the Leinster job.
OK, Wes, how relevant is this relationship between Joe Schmidt and the provincial coaches? We have this perception that he is absolutely paramount here and he clicks his fingers and they react.
It's hugely relevant. First of all, in their defence, the idea that the minutes would have dropped from 2009 to now by the equivalent of 2.5 games in half a season, effectively, from September to now, is completely acceptable, because the argument is clear that the demands of the game have risen exponentially
in that
10 years as well, so that obviously the management of them has to cater to those changing demands. Mm. But in terms of how important it is, unwittingly there in that response, I think the IRFU have kind of taught us just how important it is, because they've now insisted that it's not just about the national team, it's about every player at every level across the whole umbrella of Irish rugby. So if that is the case, well, then obviously it's the most important thing driving playing policy.
OK, and would we take from that that there is, and rightly so, a concern that the wider public is beginning to put pressure on the whole safety thing in a new way, and that rugby is constantly going to have to fight this battle?
It would seem that the main benefit of it, to the unknowing eye, is injury prevention.
Sure.
And freshness. You know, we hear about these booster weeks from time to time. The players take 2 weeks out to get to top up their S&C for a week. And I think that's fair. I think where the problem with it that people have is, it's hard. That's not to say it's not effective, or that's not to say that they're not basically, you know, he who pays the piper calls the tune. If this is the way they want to approach it, that's their prerogative, really. But it can't be argued that the integrity of selection at provincial level is fundamentally compromised. I mean, it's inarguable. If you're told who you can pick when, to some degree or other, then the integrity of it is compromised.
And is that why it doesn't exist in black and white, the protocol, anywhere? It's just an understanding.
And I mean, it's been a perfect storm in that the management of it has coincided at a time. I mean, we talked about John Mitchell's comments and how maybe the perception of Ireland playing this very attritional style is a bit outdated. But, I mean, we're maybe not the most physically endowed team out there, but we play a very attritional brand of rugby. Yeah. So the need for management is even exacerbated by that. And we've, a management team that I suppose the common perception is they're very detail-focused, let's say. So it all ties in nicely there. But, I mean, the New Zealand system was often quoted as something for us to aspire to. Now it's been quoted as they aspire to us. Strange how one result can frame that paradigm. Mm. But the New Zealand system, to me, is artificial. I mean,
why?
Because the fundamental purpose, if you're a supporter or you're a player with, whether it's Munster, Leinster or North Harbour,
your allegiance
is your identity and your allegiance. And if that's completely malleable, to the point of players being moved almost willy-nilly, to their game time and selection being managed. Well, what's the point at a certain level?
Mm-hmm. And I think if you're looking at our rivals, you mentioned New Zealand, but England are coming to town this weekend, and they're the most obvious, you know, to look at how they deal with their players. Last season alone, Owen Farrell played 944 more minutes for club and country than Johnny Sexton, which is a difference
944
of
more
minutes, which is a difference of more than 11 full games of rugby.
I mean, that is crazy. And like, that's the merits of it right there. There's no disputing that.
No, but I mean,
it's a slightly different argument. It depends on what your, it depends on what floats your boat as a supporter, I suppose, how you view it sometimes, you know?
Sure, but I suppose we are sold.
The merits of it scientifically are beyond reproach. We know that.
Understood. But the emotional engagement with your province should be something that you don't have to worry about.
Yeah, and I sound like I'm aware of the possibility you sound foolish when an Irish team has just won a double.
Yeah.
And in the same year, we've won a Grand Slam. So obviously, it's manageable. You could possibly say it's manageable for Leinster with their superior natural resources.
Okay.
Does everyone else feel the same? I'm not so sure.
Yeah, okay. Well, talking of attritional rugby, let's welcome our first guest on the line, Stephen Ferris. How are you, Fez?
Not too bad, thank you, Dara. A bit battered and bruised after playing in Kilimanjaro there the last couple of weeks, but I survived.
Yeah, fair dues to you, because we're all familiar with middle-aged lads bumming money for snazzy holidays and pretending it's for charity, but you actually raised a couple of hundred thousand, and it wasn't very pleasant, I gather.
No, it was tough. I completely underestimated what Kilimanjaro involved, and you know, I put in a good bit of training previous to doing it. But you know, nothing can prepare you for you know, a monsoons of rain and you know, snow at the top of the mountain and sleep deprivation and lastly sharing a tent with Mike McCarthy. You know, I think that was the straw that broke the camel's back.
Yeah, and he's such a gentlemanly person whenever I've come across him, but you've a different version of Mike McCarthy to reveal, have you?
Absolutely. He's fond of the baby wipes, that's all I can say. he likes to keep himself very clean and hygienic. That can be tough on the side of Mount Kilimanjaro, but we had good fun. It was good crack, but as I said, it was very, very tough. But all in the aid of a very good cause in the RFU Charitable Trust, which helps severely injured rugby players. And, you know, I think all in all, there's been over £200,000 raised. And again, I think there'll be some more money raised this coming weekend at the Ireland Legends game. I know the majority of that money is going to the Doddy Weir Foundation. But yeah, it was a great trip, Dara, but it's good to be back home, I can assure you.
Yeah, fair enough. Sounds honest to me. I mean, but there is, I won't say an industry, and it's all coming from the right place. We all know Damien Brown, and like the next thing Damien Brown does, I'm going to worry about. It's going to be something like being, you know, a space tourist or something, because he does such extreme stuff to raise money for charity. But are you now finished with it? Are you going to find yet another Everest, no pun intended, or scale to peak?
That's me done, Dar. That's me. That's, you know, something that I've always wanted to do is you know, climb a pretty high mountain and to climb the tallest single standing mountain in the world at 5,895 metres, to experience the altitude. It was very unique, but that's me definitely done. The ankles, the knees, and just the living conditions on the mountain were very, very tough. So, yeah, the poles are hung up, and I think some porter now in Africa is wearing my mountain boots. So, yeah, I've no more clobber to get up any more mountains. So that's me done.
You're retired from that as well. Excellent.
Yes. Totally.
What about the player management thing? I mean, obviously, and Wes made the good point that the 10 years that we're talking for this piece, there's been a sea change in the attritionality, if that's even a word of it. But do you remember gagging to play for Ulster and being told that you weren't going to?
Yes and no. I think when it was coming up to, like, the Autumn Internationals, even the couple of weeks before I actually hurt my ankle in 2012, 2nd November 2012 against Edinburgh one Friday night, and Declan Kidney was on the phone to me a couple of days previous to that match, and he said, "Stevie, look, you're going to be involved next week against Argentina. You don't have to play this match." And I was like, "Look, Declan, I've been out for the last few weeks with a few back spasms and a couple of other issues. You know, I need to get some game time under my belt before taking on the Argentinians and then De Viva." So I went ahead and played that match. He kind of left the ball in my court, so to speak. But now it seems to be more or less taken out of the player's hands. You know, at least I had a decision whether I wanted to play or get game time, or you know, get rid of some of the ring rust that might have occurred back then, especially when I was out for a few weeks. But it's looking at the match minutes and a lot of the articles that have been published over the last week, there are a few, you know, it's very evident that there are a few are restricting those match minutes, but you got to raise a glass to him as well, because you know, I think their performances on the pitch over the last couple of years has really shown that restricting match minutes during the league is certainly having a beneficial impact when it comes to the national team.
I know. I mean, there's no point in over-intellectualising it, really, because it's like the Simon Zeebo question. 12 months ago, it was, oh, what'll we do without Simon Zeebo? Now we're winning. Nobody cares. It's now, like, what'll we do about this player management that they're not playing it often enough for their provinces? Ireland are winning gloriously. Nobody cares.
Yeah, I think you're right. But I think also guys who are getting rested, guys who are preparing for Six Nations or Autumn Internationals or World Cups, that also gives younger fellas within the provinces an opportunity to come in and shine. If the big players were playing week in, week out, every single match, you know, you wouldn't see the likes of Robert Balakoon coming in for Ulster and making a name for himself. You wouldn't see that happening. So I think they've got the balance just right. Of course, everybody who pitches up to the RDS or Thomond Park or the Sports Ground or Kingspan Stadium, they want to see the big players playing week in, week out. That's what they pay their season ticket money for. But of course, they got to understand also that these big players take a lot of bashings week in, week out, and that they do need to rest the bodies. And you know, I think going forward, it's a very, very good way for the RFU to get the best out of their players.
Yeah, it is. It's a different type of relationship, a 24-match-a-season relationship with the team as a provincial supporter compared to, like, almost every game being must-win for the national side. But tell me, have you heard, like, today, I mentioned it a minute ago, it seems to be the Henshaw at 15 is the story that's being more or less reported as fact. What's your opinion on that?
Yeah, there's been chat of that for the last couple of years, of Robbie Henshaw playing at 15. I'm not so sure. You know, I think if Rob Carney is fit, he will start. If he's not fit, then somebody like Jordan Larmer can come in and do a great job. To just throw Robbie Henshaw into a mammoth game, England is home, can always be a bit of a banana skin the first game, and you need to get off to a winning start, especially to keep the momentum going in the Six Nations. I'm not sure that Joe Smith would be willing to take that risk. And is it a risk? I'm not really sure either, Dara, but it's one that can be argued. But for me, I would stick to type, and if Rob Carney's fit, play him. If not, then go with the other guys that's been tried and tested over the last 18 months also.
Yeah, I guess, Wes, the whole thing about that is just doesn't sound Joe to me, that he would do something. It sounds like a little bit left field for Joe.
Yeah, well, he certainly wouldn't be doing it unless he was confident it was going to work. But, I mean, there has been a trend for the last year or two that the teams do seem to slip out into the ether a day or two before they're officially announced. So it seems like there's some substance to it. But, yeah, like Stephen said, when you have you're actively trialling guys for a 31-man World Cup squad, be it Larmer, Will Addison, Andrew Conway, seems slightly unusual to go to Robbie Henshaw, but he did play 15 for the start
for
of his
years,
career.
Yeah,
so.
I just don't buy that this would be in any way a World Cup inflected decision. I think it's availability inflected, but the Rob Carney injury is really where we're narrowing this down to. Is Rob Carney, or not injury, fitness?
Well, he played the weekend, so he's shown it in the past, in fairness to him. He's been able to come in at short notice and perform. He's a favourite of Joe's, so.
Well, most recently against New Zealand, because there was talk ahead of that match. When Larmer was in for Argentina, there was talk of whether Larmer would keep his place, and Carney came in, and probably only Peter O'Mahony played better than Carney that day. So I wonder if it was Rob Carney and that was the way it was going, I presume he wouldn't be that pleased if he rates himself as fit, that he would want to know what more would he have to do. I know that he didn't have a great game for Leinster, but you think
surely the Carney question is gone. I mean, he's just come back with everybody pointing fingers at him and blown the lights out, you know.
Yeah. So that,
more than once.
I mean, that's Rob Carney will start if he's fully fit.
Fez, are you there? Are you gone?
Yeah, no, I'm still here. Derek, I remember you us actually chatting about it just off air. during the Autumn Internationals, and we were like, can we please put this Rob Kearney story to bed? If Rob Kearney is fit, he starts for Ireland. You know, so many people have kind of written him off over the last number of years and said, oh, who's going to come in? Rob doesn't offer that much in counter-attack, blah, blah, blah. He's safe as houses, and when it comes to the big games, he always pitches up. And it doesn't matter if he's been out for a couple of months or he struggled with fitness. He always seems to do it in the big games. So I agree with the lads. If he's fit, he'll start.
And if he needed to get to that last 50 metres up to the top of Kilimanjaro, he'd be able to do it from your experience.
He certainly would. He's probably a bigger engine than me, so he wouldn't have any hassle.
Okay, great. Thanks for joining us, Stephen. Enjoy the weekend, and we'll chat to you soon. Kilimanjaro used to be a HP ice cream in the 1980s. I don't know, does anyone remember it? You don't, anyway.
No.
Not me.
No.
All right. Daddy Dara. This is the RTE Rugby Podcast, available on iTunes, Spotify, RTE.ie, SoundCloud, or wherever you get your podcasts from. And the next person I'd like you to meet is Elaine Buckley. And you know those fab montages we do at the start and finish of big events in RTE Sport, the slow-mo sweat pictures and splashes and anthemic soundtracks and all the rest of it. Elaine does loads of those, but she's also a rugby nut, and a women's rugby nut in particular. She and her buddy Alison Donnelly have joined the RTE Rugby Podcast. So, Elaine, you're going to chat to Alison in a minute and bring her into our discussion. What are the overarching things ahead of Friday's kickoff?
Well, I suppose the two teams have been named now, so we kind of have a better idea of how things are going to line out on Friday.
No Lindsay Peat?
No Lindsay Peat for Ireland. Ali Miller on the bench. Three new caps all on the bench. Some interesting combinations kind of throughout the field. And then England just named their team this morning as well. So pretty daunting prospect when you look at the 15 laid out in front. Coming back from set playing seven, you have Emily Scarrett and Jess Breach in the starting 15, and then Mo Hunt is on the bench. So, it's going to be a pretty big task ahead on Friday night.
Can I ask you the question, the kicker question? What's going to happen for us, we know? England have a few options.
England have a few options, certainly. McLean at 10 and Emily Scarrett is as well able of kicking at the posts at 13 as well.
Yeah.
From an Ireland perspective, you know, it's a position that they've struggled to... It's a role that they've struggled to lock down, really, since Niamh Briggs initially got injured. Nora Stapleton took it on then. She's since retired. Throughout the Autumn Internationals and in the warm-up game against Wales, you know, a couple of different people have had a pop at it. Hannah Tyrrell kicked in last year's Six Nations. She's off with the Seven squad. We've had Leah Lyons try. We've had Michelle Claffey in the warm-up game against Wales. Nicola Fowley, who's starting at 10 on Friday night. So I suppose it is a big issue for Ireland heading into this Six Nations.
It's a distraction too. I mean, this should be you should have a kicker who can deliver a 30, 40-yard field position, you know?
Well, you should, but also from place kicks, like to kind of contextualise, I suppose. It's 10 years since Ireland first beat France in the Six Nations, their first time ever beating them. The score that night down in Ashburn was 7-6.
Yeah.
Try from Fiona Coughlan and Niamh Briggs with the conversion. So had that conversion not been made, that bit of history wouldn't be there. Mm. And that kind of carries on to 2013, the Grand Slam win. 6-0 against Italy in the decider over in Turin. Two penalties kicked the wildest weather conditions.
Yeah.
And the All Blacks game, 2014 World Cup, that was 14-0, two converted tries up to the 70th minute. Niamh Briggs made the penalty. So I'm not saying it has to be Niamh Briggs, but there has been no natural successor to become the real, assume that responsibility to win decisive matches.
And we know that we're in transition and all the rest of it. Dare I ask Niamh Briggs why she's playing good club rugby, I hear.
Yeah, I'm not too sure, to be honest. Like in the absence of a dedicated place kicker, it does seem a bit of a strange omission. But I suppose they're in such a transitional stage at the moment. We do need to develop the next place kicker.
Yeah. Okay. Good afternoon to you, Alison. Tell me what about Scrum Queens and the preview. It was actually Elaine said it to me before we came on. It was just that we're all hung up on who's playing sevens and who's playing 15s. Same across the water.
Yeah, absolutely. I think sevens has had such an impact on the women's 15th game in recent years, not just in Europe, but right across the world. And it's interesting to look at how different nations are running their programmes, and everybody's doing it slightly differently. More and more teams starting to completely separate out their programmes, even England doing that this year. And I've been trying to do that for a few years. And France, interestingly, you know, people who don't know the women's game very well will assume that France will be favourite to this year's tournament. But actually, you know, they've taken some of their very good backs to New Zealand and to Sydney with them for the next couple of weeks because they're trying to qualify for the Olympics next year. So Sevens does have a big impact on this year's women's tournament. And, of course, the women's tournament is at a very different stage to the men's World Cup cycle. We're 2 years away from the next women's World Cup. So there's a lot more experimentation going on, a lot more fluidity between Sevens and 15s in the women's game. So it'll be quite an interesting tournament.
And in terms of, I suppose, the opening weekend of action, Alison, how do you see the impact of the players that are down in the summer, Southern Hemisphere playing sevens? How is it going to affect the championship in the opening weekend?
Yeah, I mean, England would be favourites coming to Ireland regardless, but I think the returning players that you've mentioned, Emily Scarrett, Mohan, Jess Breach, do make them a much better team, and that's just a simple fact. They are three world-class players, and the other player coming back, Sarah Byrne, has been injured for a year. Those of you who watched the Women's World Cup in Dublin will remember, and Belfast will remember how powerful that young prop is, and she's been out injured. So I think England, you know, will benefit from the change that they have made, and certainly, you know, what Ireland can hope for, I think, is that they'll be a little rusty. Some of the players haven't played 15th Test rugby for a couple of years, and hope they can sort of put pressure on them in that respect. I think France will still be very much favoured to beat Wales, despite the fact that they're losing, you know, probably their starting fullback, their starting fly half are not with them. But they're at home and they'll have a huge crowd down in Montpellier, and, you know, they won't fear Wales, even with some of those players missing. Scotland, Italy, I think, a much more interesting game and much better respect. Italy, one of the more experienced teams, they've picked a very settled looking squad. And they beat Scotland very comprehensively in the autumn. So they will go to Scotland not considering that away trip. You know, away wins are very hard to come by in the women's game as much as the men's game. But I think, you know, France and England this weekend will come through. I think it'll be later on before we see the real impact for them.
Alison, just as your line is a bit crackly, I'm going to jump in ahead of Elaine. Excuse me, Elaine, and just say, roughly speaking, broad brushstrokes, a target for Ireland in the coming 7-8 weeks.
This weekend, do you mean?
No, over the course of the championship.
Yeah, I mean, I think third has got to be their realistic target. They did that last time, and that is where they are now at the moment in this World Cup cycle. They're not going to be good enough, I don't think, to beat England. And France, you know, a difficult game for them always. They have beaten them, of course, in the past a couple of times. But I think this French team is a real up-and-coming French team. They've just beaten New Zealand. They're the Grand Slam champions currently. They will be hard to beat. But I think third would be a good return for Ireland. But, you know, that's not going to be easy for them. And that's just because that's where they are in their transition.
Brilliant. Thank you.
And Alison, in terms of a third place finish, you know, it was one of the clear objectives set out in the IRFU Women in Rugby Action Plan between 2018 to 2023. But as we saw last year, you know, Ireland have achieved a top three finish since 2009. But last year we lost to Scotland for the first time since 2006. In the way the world rankings pan out now, we're no longer kind of guaranteed that third place finish. So in terms of the chasing pack, what do you see as the key clashes for Ireland there?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's also because all of the other teams are getting better too. You know, Ireland evolved very quickly over a period of years, and a really great set of squad, the likes of sort of, you know, I'm thinking of the Lynn Cantwell, Fiona Coughlin era, and then they really sort of pushed boundaries beyond what people felt, you know, a nation of Ireland's size and investment were capable of. And, you know, the reality is that others have caught up, and Scotland are investing in their coaching and they're investing in their players, and they have some professional players now, and they're obviously sending players to France and so on. So no, you know, nothing will get easier for Ireland, that's for sure. And of course, trying to keep up on the World Series stage and qualify for big tournaments is going to put pressure on them in a way that it's not putting pressure on, say, Wales and Scotland, who are not quite at that level of sevens just yet. I mean, Ireland should be beating Scotland, Italy and Wales. That they should be. But like I said, teams are investing more and more, and they obviously see the benefits of, you know, the return in cash investment. It, you know, it's helpful, and, you know, more and more sort of interest and exposure of the women's game means that unions are under pressure to put money into it. And so, you know, they had gone ahead and now they're being pulled back a little bit. But, you know, there's still a lot of time between now and the next World Cup, and Adam Griggs is obviously picking some interesting young players, and he will hope that there's plenty of time between now and when we head to New Zealand in a couple of years' time that, you know, they can be back to perhaps where they were in 2014.
That's excellent, Alison. Thanks again. And scrumqueens.com is the definitive website for news, information, analysis, opinion about women's rugby. Elaine, just very quickly, in terms of the weekend to come, do you want to give us a couple of... We're missing out on Bevan or... is it Bevan or Bevine Parsons?
Bevan Parsons.
None of the above. So, unfortunately, because we all get excited with a young player, especially with gas like that. But who else do we have to look for on Friday evening?
Yeah, I think it's actually quite an exciting team lineup in that there's not the usual panic over the backs that are gone off to play sevens. Megan Williams had a really, really strong debut Six Nations last year. It's great to see her back in there starting on the wing. Emer Considine, I think, is going to be a really, really key player for Ireland. We missed her last year. She was on a year out travelling, but she was so promising in the Autumn Internationals. She scored tries against USA and England. Yes, we didn't win those matches, but even in attack, in defence, she was a key player in those two games. It's Lauren Delaney, another big find of the Autumn Internationals, to have someone to fill that kind of fullback role that has been, they've struggled to fill it really since Niamh Briggs initially got injured. And Michelle Claffey starting in the centre alongside Senene Opu, another interesting combination. They've played at club together, they've played at provincial level together, so hopefully they can bring a bit of that unity into the international setup.
There could be chemistry there, yeah, good mix. This is the RTE Rugby Podcast. Now we're going to, just before we preview the game on Saturday, and I know Wes has some theories about the Exeter defence strategy against Munster recently possibly coming into play this weekend. Just a couple of points. I don't know, does anyone want to make a comment on? But again, like my Kilimanjaro ice cream comment, Hot Press Magazine used to be for people who hated rugby, and now it's running interviews with Jordan Larmour. So, I mean, there's an indication of the spread of rugby. And in the reverse, the school I went to, Christians in Cork, is in its first Hearty Cup hurling for 101 years.
Yeah.
So we are becoming a polysported country, Wesley.
We are, yeah. Christians certainly wasn't a hurling stronghold for a long time. I think we are, and we've quite publicly had these points made before, but I think it's, if you want to be accurate about it, we're... rugby is now absolutely at the top table as a spectator sport. Does it, you know, do its tentacles reach
into the
country? Probably not.
But aren't we allowed to engage at different levels at different times, you know?
I suppose it inherited a certain ABC1 consumer base when it went professional that made it very attractive, especially when there was success, to advertisers. The IRFU and other brands that have jumped on it have done a pretty good job in packaging it, and we've been very lucky or planned, strategised well with having very good teams that have fuelled it.
But a lot of the barriers were artificial or imaginary, and that's what I'm saying. If it goes both ways, they come down. I mean, rugby schools playing hurling, hurling supporters going to rugby matches.
Yeah.
And I'll say we're all a beautiful nation and that we all have see eye to eye on everything, but it does drag us together.
Yeah, but I mean, I've never known it to be any other way.
Mm-hmm. In Limerick in particular.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, I mean, yeah. Okay. Great, all for it.
What's your take, Michael, on tactical approach? There's this, I might be talking through my backside here, but there does seem to be a sense to this Six Nations that it's about finding what, if it exists, Ireland's weak spot is. And many have tried and all have failed.
Yeah, I think that the consensus is that Ireland are in a place now where it's up to other teams to find out how to beat them. But what also Joe has to realise, that because they're there, other teams have seen them and they will really target them. And Joe might have to throw in something that they haven't seen before, like we saw against New Zealand, and he has these intricate moves. So where England are coming from, they may be, I think that they were going to play Tuilagi and Tio if Tio's they had a chance. And Tio's out now. So they may not just put in another guy like him, and they'll go with the two playmakers, which is Farrell and Ford. So that may change up what they were probably intending to do.
But haven't they tried that before?
They have tried that before. I mean,
worked for a long time too.
Yeah, it's
true.
You know,
they nearly broke a world record of consecutive wins with the twin playmakers. So
yeah, we do have a binary view of it, because it was only when the wheels fell off there in 2017 that things went down.
I think he's been desperate to get Tuilagi fit and on the pitch for a long time. The Tuilagi that maybe doesn't even exist anymore, the guy that destroyed New Zealand at Twickenham 5 years ago. But you know, it's a simple view, but Tuilagi, Vunipola into the one team, it makes it a much more daunting proposition.
And about Vunipola coming back in, he was missing last year, of course, but he was actually there 2 years ago, and I was just looking at some of the stats. So he was there. We're all supposed to be afraid of him coming back in. Yeah, sure, he's a great player. Last year, or 2 years ago, Ireland contained him very well. He had 7 runs for 16 metres. His opposite number that day, Stander, had 20 runs for 26 metres. So Ireland marshalled him very well. And it's not just that he's coming back and Ireland don't have someone to deal with him.
2017, was it? Yeah.
2 years ago. So, yeah, Ireland have dealt with him in the past. They're not afraid of him. Ireland's back row is solid. I mean, it'll be O'Mahony, Stander and either O'Brien or Van der Fleer, more than likely. Those lads are no...
Bulk alone won't win the match. I mean, that's really what. So where's next to go? I mean, anyone want to chip in on that? What is, you know, we heard like Eddie Jones saying he was going to play Jack Noel as number 7 at some stage, possibly. And, you know, I mean, that is not beyond the realms of possibility, but you're getting into fantasy land. What I found interesting about that is people are going to have to do something a little bit radical to dismantle the highly efficient machine. And where do we see our weaknesses? It's a different discussion to the one we have usually, which is where are the weaknesses of the opposition? This is where are our potential weaknesses. What about this way of marshalling the ruck that Exeter had?
Well, I'm not saying that I think England will attempt anything like it, but I suppose you're always kind of thinking, you know, there's always this narrative, we've a target on our back and teams look to expose us. That goes both ways in any game. So it's a bit false in some ways. But yeah, of course, everyone's going to look for how they get one over on us. They always have done. Mm-hmm. I suppose I thought Exeter's approach to the breakdown against Munster, where like Munster's efficiency of winning their own ball, retaining possession when they brought the ball into contact, was the highest in the Champions Cup leading into that game, about 97%. And Exeter kind of seemed to be willing to cede possession, which resulted in Munster sending one man into to rocks just to seal off possession. But then the counter-ruck kind of came when possession was secured, as opposed to during what we see as the contest for possession at the point of contact. And the purpose of that, you would imagine, I spoke to a couple of defence coaches trying to see, I wasn't imagining things, but was to put pressure on Connor's kicking rather, as well as trying to turn over possession. So I'm not saying England are going to do that, but it's something slightly new, and in a World Cup year,
it's tough to visualise.
It's always happened.
Like, I watch a lot of rugby, obviously, because of the job, but even that, I remember being at the match, and that helps you. But it's tough for a listener at home to get that. I mean, it is, we're down to really kind of...
Well, I guess when a team have won possession, generally, and the ball is at the hindmost foot, for to use an old-fashioned expression, there's an acceptance that the ball is won and there's no further contest.
Gotcha,
whereas
yeah.
they were waiting till that point to contest, because even if they got a nudge on the one man, as Connor was about to pick, well, there's a leg hitting his hand, whatever,
sloppy.
He's put off. The kicking game is neutralised. The possession has slowed down. So, I mean, it just struck me as an example that as we are more heralded, teams will look at different things potentially to try and bring us down. But, you know, they always did, I guess. And you'd be pretty confident we've got a coach there that's going to be just as well prepped on any of the opposition as they are on us.
Yeah, I mean, I have a very unscientific way. I think that like it's impossible to see Ireland being beaten unless they fall 2 scores behind. I just think that they don't make enough mistakes to...
Well, they don't seem to give you less than a 7.5 out of 10. They're not going to turn up and be terrible.
Yeah.
They're not going to beat themselves. So you're going to have to go out and beat them. So their default is, you know, England might turn up and give us 10 out of 10. They might turn up and give us 6. Ireland are going to be 7.5, 8 out of 10
yeah.
or better
yeah.
every day.
Okay. I think it'd be interesting to see how England actually approach the match, because at the Six Nations launch last week, Eddie Jones was in his usual jovial form, but he did say that in the autumn series, he noticed that the Ireland game plan evolving. He said they kicked less and passed more against New Zealand and Argentina. And he goes, will we see that in the Six Nations, or is it's going to be colder, different time of year? Do they revert to type? Can England cope with either or as well? Remains to be seen.
What about all this pool noodle stuff during the social media rounds that they were annoying Mike Brown, who we don't know whether he'll play or not, with the pool noodle, you know, that styrofoam thing? As a way of distracting him, because they were just bombing him all day long. They expect an aerial game, surely.
They make Mike Brown seem to be completely indestructible in the air, so he's under a lot of pressure. If he does happen to come in or see any involvement, if he doesn't catch everything, they'll be questioning what he's doing.
I loved him as a player, but I think he's past it.
Yeah, well, I'd have to agree with you there.
They want to back three or four backs, it seems, you know. Like, he's said categorically he's picking a team and a squad and a set of tactics purely for this game.
Right, so selection dilemmas, apart from Henshaw, anything else?
No, I think the only under argument is the open side and...
Van der Fleer has been mentioned as on the team sheet, isn't he? Already? Yeah, and it's then... Wednesday afternoon now.
Yeah, and then, I mean, if Sean O'Brien comes in, you're just gaining a line.
Okay, anyone have a grenade ala Eddie to throw in before we wrap up, guys?
I'd like to see Andrew Conway at 15. Be curious to see
starting,
how it would work out.
If Carney is fit...
Yeah, I think he kind of suffered from being overhyped because the expectation on him as a schoolboy was so great. And I think he's maybe suffering from being underappreciated at this point in time. But he's been excellent for about 2 years now. I think a lot of Munster fans would like to see him at 15 and Darren Sweetenham on the wing. But he's been playing on the wing with Mike Haley, a full back lately. So that probably works against him. But, I mean, he's just incredible, challenging on your own possession under the high ball. He's excellent. Saw the likes of that try against Toulon last year, what he has to offer an attack, blistering pace.
He's a player at his peak.
Yeah, I think he's just massively improved over the last couple of years, you know. So, I mean, I'd be curious to see if he could do a job there, but it's probably not the game to, not the selection to make, just for your curiosity at this point in time.
Fair enough, but that game could come along quicker than we know. As we know, this is an amazing tournament. And look, within 24 hours, Wales or Ireland or England or France will be licking their wounds. The victorious duo, assuming there's no draws, will be driving on to the following weekend. And yeah, the tank is full and it's all about to ignite. All right, so don't forget that the match is on Radio 1, full live coverage. You'll have Don Lennon and Corky, Michael Corcoran, doing the commentary for you. And we'll be back with Against the Head. This is all traditional media stuff on Monday. And don't forget to join us for Women's Six Nations live from 4:45 on RTE2 this Friday and on Radio 1 Extra. And that's a first bit of a doubleheader with the under-20s at 7 then. So thanks for listening. Thanks to Elaine, Wes, Declan, Michael and Stephen Ferris a little bit earlier. And hope you enjoyed the programme. Take it easy.